So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And it is yet another Thursday here in beautiful Middle Tennessee.
It is.
We've got a great conversation on tap.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you've been out doing a little gardening, haven't you?
I have. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I was up at the lake this weekend, and we have a plan there for my friend's house that includes a vegetable garden, which is awesome. It's going to be a little one, you know.
Okay, good.
His house is on the top of a big hill.
Yeah.
A steep driveway goes with a big hill. And I drew the straw of literally carrying the bales of pine straw up the steep hill.
Okay.
And which I thought was okay.
Sure.
You know, I'm in not awful shape. I'm actually in terrible shape. So I found out. And so we're planting all these plants and carrying the pine straw and then we decided we need rocks. Because there's a drainage issue
okay.
where the rocks,
okay,
you know, the water
sure.
comes
so you
down,
need to,
so you
yeah,
can't
right.
wash
You've got
out
to baffle
the plants.
Water a little bit.
Yeah,
sure.
So
right.
so we go to borrow some rocks.
Okay.
That I'm sure in 30 years will get returned. and so we're schlepping rocks.
Those have got to be carried up
and
the hill.
And they also individually,
yeah.
by the way.
Okay.
And have to be carried up and. Nate,
you feel a little like Sisyphus at the end, don't you? Just kind of
it's uphill forever. Yes.
Yeah, right.
This is what they do in hell. They carry rocks up hills for days at a time, and there's never a downhill.
Yeah.
And by the end, we did get our vegetables in, and the plants are beautiful, and he's very happy with the space.
Yeah.
But as you know, at the end of the day, and my dog Lily, the Great Pyrenees, you know, who was bred for hills, you know, she climbs them like a mountain goat. Now,
sure.
she, you know, she's in the height of her glory because, you know, what's hard about this?
Yeah.
But we were killing it. And I'm telling you, it was like, good grief. I'm not built for this.
Yeah. So.
But it's beautiful. It was a beautiful weekend, beautiful time.
The weather was fantastic. It
yeah.
really was. And I don't know whether I've said it on the podcast here. I lose track. I'm an old guy. I don't remember what I've said where. But I have taken responsibility for mowing my own lawn this year. I'm not going to hire it out as I always
yes.
have.
Yeah, you know, we talked a little about that.
Yeah, so I'm going to save myself
your
money,
electric mower.
My electric mower. And I feel pretty energetic and quite proud of myself. And I think I do a better job than the lawn service. I think I care more.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's highly possible.
Yeah.
But that's good. And how much time are you getting on your little electric mower? Is it cordless or is it?
No, yeah, it's cordless. It runs on a battery. And I have found that if I don't use the self-propelled feature, if I don't tax the battery by having it pull me around the yard, but if mm-hmm. I will actually push the machine,
mm-hmm.
I can mow my entire lawn if I hustle on one charge. And I do it in about 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's a great workout.
Yeah, no, it's very good. Yeah, that's a treadmill.
Yeah, sure. And that's a part of my recovery. Maintaining sobriety is I've got to stay physically active.
Right. And you know what I noticed this weekend as I was wheezing and gasping for air was that there's something about breathing fresh air. I mean, we talk about endorphins and exercise all the time.
Right,
you know, the endorphins are the brain's natural antidepressant and blah, blah, blah. But there's something about the fresh air, the outside air, the real stuff.
Yes.
You know, because most of us go to the gym inside and we're breathing indoor recycled air. And there's really something about the outside, real unfiltered air that just...
Absolutely. And out in the sunshine, get that vitamin D from the sun.
Absolutely.
You betcha. And you're growing vegetables,
yes,
which is going to have an impact on diet a little later in the summer.
It will, Lord willing, we will have tomatoes to share. I'll bring them back.
All another part
cucumbers,
of healthy self care.
Bell peppers, yellow tomatoes.
Really? Yeah, I planted peppers myself yesterday.
Oh, yeah. We're hoping that the peppers do okay. We had a.
I am just glad that I am not living in the fog of active addiction today,
mm-hmm.
which would have put these mundane daily tasks, or I wouldn't have had the interest or the energy to do this when I was using.
No, absolutely not. No, I wouldn't have been awake.
Yeah.
Yet at that hour, for one thing.
Yeah.
But no, not the the inclination, the initiative. And the appreciation, you know, it's the simple, really, the simple things of putting something in the ground and watching it grow.
Sure.
That in sobriety is an appreciation.
Right.
You know.
And I was so overstimulating the pleasure center of my brain and my body and my brain, my body, in order to try to maintain internal equilibrium, had dialed back my pleasure response so much that I still function, that ordinary pleasures didn't register anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have found joy and satisfaction in mowing my lawn or weeding a garden in the way I do today.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Well, we got a great guest on tap.
We do.
Stay with us. We'll be back in a second on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And we're back in the Positive Sobriety Podcast. David, would you introduce our guest today?
I will. This is Ryan Chapman. And Ryan and I met over lunch. Ryan graciously invited me to lunch with he and his one of his directors at Integrative Life Center.
Oh, we know the Integrative Life Center.
Yeah.
We've talked about it.
Holly Cook was with him, and she's been on our podcast in the past, and talked about what they do there a little bit. Ryan, but as he shared his story with me, it has a really unique entry into the recovery, quote, business, and just how he landed in all this. And so Ryan is the CEO and owner of the Integrative Life Center in Nashville, Tennessee, here where we are.
Yeah.
And we've gotten to communicate on some things in the past and invited him. We graciously accepted his our invitation to come on the program. So,
well, just for the sake of the listeners, I have to tell them, since they're not seeing Ryan, I'm seeing Ryan. He's a lot younger than I expected him to be.
He's going on 13. For somebody like us.
How old a guy are you?
That's why I have the beard and the glasses to add
a
little bit of
distinguishment.
You're going to go for that credibility look,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Now I'll be 34 years old.
All right. Well, you carry it very well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And here you are. You've walked, as we often say here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast, a long and winding road to get to where you are. And here you are now as the leader of a very innovative and groundbreaking treatment center. And you're in the field of addiction treatment and recovery. Do you have an addiction story of your own?
Sure, yeah.
Why don't you wind it all the way back? Give us a little picture of your childhood and upbringing, and then tell us a little bit of your addiction story, if you will.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know how far we'll go, where we'll start, or how long this will be. You know, we'll try not to make a novel out of it. But I grew up in a small town in Tennessee, White House, Tennessee, on the Tennessee-Kentucky state line. Grew up to two wonderful parents, loved the game of baseball from a very young age. It was my everything, whether it was trading sports cards or trying to get on every team that I could so I could play year round. And then started experimenting with drugs and alcohol at 13 years old. And then moved into a period of time to where I just really enjoyed altering my mental state. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be the first person to, I wanted to find a way to start partying before school ever let out, you mm-hmm. know, and I mm-hmm. wanted to be the last one to go to bed. And then in this little town, this was in late 90s, early 2000s, and in high school, OxyContin just hit this small town.
Wow.
And then that's when I went from just getting high entirely too much to now I'm finding myself as a senior in high school, really good baseball player, straight-A student, and full-blown drug addict all rolled into one and trying my best to keep those
personas.
Those are competing. And so I'm wearing one face to my mom, one face to my coach, one face to my drug addict friends, one face to an old lady that I would steal medicine from. I mean, it was just it was a life of not a lot of zero authenticity,
right,
and just really lost, you know, not knowing who I was and or who I wanted to be, you know. And so God so had it that when I was 18, I was driving home from a friend's house in the wee hours of the morning. I was high. I was driving to my parents' house. I was staying with them at the time, and I fell asleep. I nodded off, and I was driving a Jeep Grand Cherokee, and my Jeep went off the side of the road and hit a telephone pole head on.
Wow.
And the telephone pole, the way that my car struck the telephone pole just ripped through the passenger side of my Jeep. So it was basically in the passenger seat.
Wow.
But I was uninjured just because it came just ripping and roaring through that one side. It really left the other side alone. And so I managed to get myself out of the Jeep, really, you know, cut, but, you know, not injured. And I walked a mile up the road and then walked another mile up a farmer's driveway and knocked on this, you know, farmer's door in the wee hours of the morning and convinced this guy to call my parents as opposed to calling the police. And my dad came up and cleaned out my Jeep, and I woke up the next morning and at my parents' house, and all I could remember was that I knew that something really bad had happened, and that it involved my Jeep, but I couldn't remember any other scenes of the movie. And so I was able to, I could look outside my bedroom window and see where I usually parked my Jeep. And so I went to the window, and I was sore, and I went to the window and looked out, and I didn't see it. So that's when I knew that it was probably pretty bad, you know, if it didn't make it home with me that night. And so I went downstairs, and my parents said, we can't watch you kill yourself anymore. You either need to go and figure out life on your own apart from us, or you need to go and get some help. And God so had it that on the day that I got an ultimatum from my parents, I was scared shitless once I realized what happened the night before.
Sure.
You know, like, I almost died and I don't remember it. If anybody was riding with me, they wouldn't have had a chance. I would have taken somebody's life. If someone was driving the other direction, you know, I mean, I had went from, because I hadn't really felt a lot of true consequences from my addiction, and because I overcompensated it in other ways, I had almost felt invincible. Right? Like, this is like, I can't, something really bad can't happen to me. And this was the shock of like, hey, you're going, this is the path you're on. Like, you're going to die, you know? And so I went to Cumberland Heights at 18 years old in February 2003.
Wow.
And just had an amazing experience at Cumberland Heights. It was It was the first place in my adult life, or my adolescent, young adult life, that I just said, I don't know any of these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm scared. I'm going to show up here, and I'm going to be me. And I'm going to try and figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to try and trick all these people like I've tried to trick everybody else in my life before.
Right.
Like, I'm just going to show up and try and figure out who the hell I am, because I don't know who the hell I am, right?
Yeah.
And so it was just an amazing experience. I had a good group of guys kind of in there with me, had great therapists, had, you know, just really, I mean, I just look back on, like, rehab, I mean, I picture it like a lot of people, like, look back on college, like a period of their life, like how I look back on rehab, like, it was just special for me,
it
changed the entire trajectory that I was on.
And,
you know, obviously life wasn't perfect after that. You know, you got to go back to living life. But in terms of, like, a place to reorientate myself, it was amazing. And there was a little chapel there on the campus of Cumberland High. It's still there. And I've always been an awful sleeper. And I would go, and there was no, God wasn't in our house growing up. Mm-hmm. There was no, it wasn't adversarial with God. It just wasn't present.
Right.
And so the only time that I was exposed to God was if I would stay, you know, small town Tennessee, if you stay at somebody's house on Saturday night that their parents go to church, you wake up and go to church with them, you know?
And
so, but that was my only exposure. But I would go into that chapel, and in that chapel was the first time that I felt like I wasn't alone in the world, and that something... that something, someone, somebody, somewhere saved me from that accident, and that had me on that campus, had me in that chapel, you know, and it was just a, that was the place of my spiritual awakening.
And
so I didn't have a story behind it. I didn't have a faith behind it. I didn't have knowledge, you know, I mean, I didn't know. It was not defined.
Yeah.
But the
wasn't
fact
a
that.
Theological perspective or anything
the
like
that. The fact
that
there was more to the world than what I knew or saw.
Yeah.
I made that realization. Yeah. So that began at treatment. So that's part of the, I guess, the nostalgic experience to it as well.
So. So you, when you leave treatment, then you're college age, right?
Yes.
And so you head to, was it Vanderbilt?
No. So I'm 18. I get out of Cumberland Heights. I go move into a halfway house that they recommended, and I have the great idea of me and three of my buddies that I went to treatment with, and we've been living at the halfway house with. We're gonna go run a house together, you know. And so we go run a house together, and that's a complete shit show debacle.
Right,
you know,
sure, you can imagine what could go wrong.
Four 18, 19, 20 year olds with a few months clean renting a house in Nashville. You know, And so that went the way that you guys can guess that it did. And then I ended up working in another, living in another, not working, living in another halfway house. And in that halfway house, my dad was taking a job in Orlando, Florida. So my mother and my father and my seven-year-old brother were moving from White House to Orlando, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad called one day and he said, I'm going to give a personal goodbye to some people that I liked working with. Would you like to come along with me for the day? And so my dad was a civil engineer, and so he did a lot of work for real estate developers. And so one of the guys that we met that day was a guy named Tony Giratana. And I had never met him before in my life. He was planning to build the Viridian Tower at the time.
Right, yeah.
And so I had, I went into his office. You know, if, for anybody who's met Tony, he's just incredibly intelligent, passionate, just a great speaker, just an incredible presence to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, self-made. Dapperly dressed, we're in the LNC Tower downtown.
Oh, nice, yeah.
And you know, his office, there's just beautiful furniture. And I'm just 18 years old, just looking like this is what I want to be doing when I grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, you know, this guy is incredible, right? Mm-hmm. And so, at the end of the meeting, he asked me if I wanted to go to work, and so I said, sure. I was like, you know, I'm taking a couple college classes, so I had re-enrolled at Tennessee State University, when I was 18. And I registered for a couple classes. I was just part-time. But I told Tony, what days of the week I could come to work. And so we agreed on a day and time for me to show up. And I wore my best and only suit and tie. Mm-hmm. You know, I figured if he was wearing one, then I should wear one too if I wanted to be him when I grew up. You know? So I left the halfway house in my best and only suit and tie. And his assistant, Mindy, when I got there, said, Tony wants you to go see Saeed Saeed on the lot, the corner of 5th and Church. And so I went and saw Saeed Saeed. Saeed Saeed gave me a flag and a stack of tickets and $51 bills. I was the best dressed parking attendant that Nashville, Tennessee has ever seen or will ever see again. And that was November 11, 2003. That was my first day in the parking business.
Wow.
So it was 9 months after I had went to treatment. Yeah. Second halfway house.
Yeah.
Job making $6.75 an hour, flagging cars into the lot and sweeping up cigarette butts.
And you thought you were going to be the apprentice or something.
Yeah. No, it was kind of a rude awakening. But, Tony is a real estate developer. He's a visionary.
Right.
And he got into the parking business simply because this one piece of land where he wanted to put a building happened to have a temporary revenue generating source
potential,
as a parking lot.
Sure.
You know, but he never set out to really be in the parking business.
Right.
And so, as an 18-year-old kid, I just kept having these ideas of like, hey, why are we doing it this way? Because Tony wasn't active in the management of the parking.
Right.
It just wasn't, this wasn't how he spent his day. And so I put together these lists of like, well, why aren't we doing it this way?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I asked my dad, I was like, well, I got this list. Like, I think that there's a lot of things that we could do and the parking lot would run a lot better and make a lot more money. And he's like, well, go see Tony and see if he'll have coffee with you. And so I went and saw Tony and I got like halfway through the list. And when I got halfway through the list, he said, go for it. Those are good ideas. Mm-hmm. I support you. You know, I mean, they make sense. Go do them. And so I just marched out of that meeting. I'd promoted myself from parking attendant to CEO. You know, I was going to go and make some things happen. And we did them, and none of these were rocket. You know, we implemented these ideas, and none of them were rocket science, and the revenue of the lot doubled.
Yeah.
Wow.
And to an 18-year-old kid, the amount of money that this parking lot was making was big money.
Yeah, sure.
And especially when I'm making $6.75 an hour, you know? And so I saw, and these were my ideas, you know, that caused this. And so what I started seeing was that there were other parking lots that needed some of these ideas implemented on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Tony and I said, I want to start a parking management company. I want to take what we did here. I want to go and apply it to other lots and garages.
Right.
And he was like, well, what do you need? I was like, well, I need your advice and your wisdom and, you know, your Rolodex and some help, you know? Uh-huh. And so we started Premier Parking.
Okay.
And over the course of 16 years, my team and I grew that to today. I can't keep up with it, but I mean, I think we have 42 off. I know that we have 42 or more offices across the country.
Wow.
2,000 or more team members. Just a incredible success story. And several of the people that I met in early recovery when I was starting the business now hold very senior positions at the company and are stockholders of the company.
Wow.
You know, I mean, the people that were with me kind of in the early days. And so we've made a lot of career dreams happen for people. It was a tremendous grind, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
there was
growing a business is not easy, and growing a business across the country when you get married and have kids and the strains that can put, you know, on a person and on a family, all those things are tough.
Because this is all across the country by now, right? This
yeah,
is all
we never tapped the Northeast, but we're all over the West Coast, all over the Texas, Oklahoma, kind of Middle America, and then Midwest and Southeast.
Right.
So we never went to the Northeast, but everywhere else in the country we have coverage. So And so about...
So you don't have to plow a lot of lots.
No. We did. Funny story, though. We one of our first big deals in Detroit Medical Center was... Our first winter weather market was Detroit, Michigan.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And we went there managing the Detroit Medical Center. Uh-huh. So managing all of their garages, their valet, their shuttle operate. So kind of transportation logistics for Detroit Medical Center. And... they were, they didn't have enough parking spaces. And so we had to go out and lease some other parking in the general area from others.
Okay.
And so we came up with this calculation of exactly how many parking spaces we thought they need and how many we needed to go and get. And that was part of our proposal to get awarded the contract.
Sure.
Well, we get awarded the contract and then winter rolls around and the snow starts falling. And they start pushing the snow in the corners of the parking lot.
And
well,
you
the
lose.
Snow doesn't melt. They keep pushing it. And eventually, I'm losing two spots at each corner.
You're
so
sure?
I'm losing eight spaces on the lot.
Yeah.
And there was multiple lots,
right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mountain keeps getting bigger. And then now it's four spaces on each corner. And so the good old Southern boy that came up with this great fancy calculation of exactly how many spaces that we didn't anticipate the snow piles.
Yeah, right.
So
oh my God.
It's just funny how you think you, it's a lot like anything else that you do. I mean, you think you got it all figured out.
Yeah.
But you don't. I mean, you always have blinders on of some form.
But so you mentioned that this had become a pretty intense business for you, a grind, and you know, wife, kids, by the time you're really, really all in with this. So what takes you from being in the parking business to even being able to consider, you know, I think I might like to buy a treatment center?
Yeah, so that was you know, another part of this, you know, long, windy road that I love. You know, I mean, I'm one of those people that it's, you know, I love my darkest days because that's the only way that I get to really, you know, stop and appreciate what I have today is just knowing the depths of some of the darkness that I've found my body and my heart and soul in.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how the transition from parking to the treatment business happened.
Mm-hmm.
Is so about 3 years, 3 years ago. So in 2016, I started just continuing to find myself more and more discontent. My patience wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I was this passion. I had this huge passion for the business.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had this huge passion, it allowed me to work extremely long hours, always be on airplanes, always be sleeping in hotel rooms. And none of that really fazed me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because I was just so excited about what I was doing and what I was building. And then this passion and excitement just started waning.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still working
I was going through the motions.
Yeah.
And it was like discontent turned to really, sadness turned to depression turned to, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know, because a big part of me was like, you know, it was like, hey, I have this incredibly successful company that I founded and I owned. I have this wife with, you know, biggest heart and a beautiful face, and I have two happy, healthy kids.
Yeah.
And you're depressed?
Mm-hmm.
Like, give me a break. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, that's the feeling that there was guilt and shame in that.
Right.
Like, how am I, like, am I screwed up? Like, look at all this stuff, and I'm not happy, you know? And so at this point in time, God put it on, it was a chance. So we had started going, my wife grew up Catholic. And I just had this kind of, you know, kind of unnamed faith that began at Cumberland Heights. And so, but then when we started having kids, we're like, neither one of us really grew up in. I didn't grow up in a church. She grew up. We wanted our kids to have a different experience than we had.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started testing out churches and we started going to a church and where my best friend, one of my best friends and his wife went and, he called me one day and he said, hey, I don't know if you know this, but some Saturday mornings I walk the mall with Carter. And I was like, Carter from church? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, you walk the mall? And I'm like, well, I didn't understand. And he was like, yeah, it's just like his thing. It's like his office. It's like, you know, none of the stores open till like 11 on Saturday, but the mall opens at 7 or something. We go and we meet, and we might study the, you know, we might study the Bible, and then we'll walk around the mall and we'll talk about life and what's going on. And he's like, and I was like, okay. And so he was like, well, your name frequently comes up when I'm talking to Carter, just because my friend and I, we travel together and we help each other out on business stuff. Our kids are our lives are close. And so he said, today, Carter said, would you mind asking this Ryan guy if he'd meet with me? And so Carter wants to meet with you. Would you be up for it? And so I said, sure. You know, I mean, as a, it's like, you know, at that point in time, I was really going to church because my wife wanted to go to church, and I wanted to be a good husband. I wasn't really, I wasn't seeking, you know? And and so going to have a mall walk with Carter was just like, when you're a CEO or just a, like, I'm just, I'll go and I like meeting people. I like people. So I'll go have coffee with whoever, right? And so I go and see Carter, and we rock around the mall, and the first time it was really just kind of a get-to-know-you session and just talking to one another, and then we set up another time to we set up a second time to meet, and that second time that we meet, God just put it on my heart to just let Carter know exactly where I was at that day, and it was a really dark day, and I will forever... I hope that they never take the Auntie Anne's pretzel shop out of Green Hills Mall, because every time that I'm at Green Hills Mall, I will picture myself and Carter Crenshaw there early one Saturday morning, me bawling my eyes out at one of the tabletops outside of Auntie Anne's pretzel shop, and him telling me that what we're going to start, how we're going to start this new journey is that he wants me to read John. And so... that was the first time that I ever opened the Bible with a seeking mentality. And so I started getting discipled by Carter, came to faith in Jesus Christ, really just started getting new eyes for the world. Just seeing my days different, seeing my opportunities different. I mean, there was a part of me where it's like, I thought for a long time, like, being the CEO of Premier was like what I was meant to do. And this was going to be my family business, and this was going to be my legacy, and, you know, maybe we'd grow it to other countries. And, I mean, that was my mentality, right? And so I started getting thoughts of, like, maybe that's not, maybe that's, maybe why I'm depressed, maybe part of the reasons why I'm depressed is because this chapter needs to end, and I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, and when I would have never kind of thought that before, I was, you know, I was so consumed. And so I'm meeting with Carter, and Carter was like, hey, I really enjoy these meetings, and I want to continue to disciple you for as long as you want to be discipled, but there's also, there's this therapist that I think that you would be, it would be really good for you to go see. And so he introduced me to this therapist, and I go and start seeing the therapist, and we start working on and having some discussions on stuff that I never had at treatment. You know, I never looked at before. I mean, we're just taking my story and stuff in my story and my habits and tendencies and my rituals and my thought process. I mean, we just start dissecting a lot of stuff that I never looked at before. Never wanted to look at before, and so
and you didn't have to because
and I didn't have
you weren't
to.
Depressed before.
And so and things just start clicking, and I'm just forming a really you know, incredible, trustworthy bond with this guy. Again, it feels like my eyes just kind of keep getting wider and wider, and you know, I just I'm having multiple dimensions as opposed to just kind of being a singularly dimensional. Dimensioned person. And then I'm sitting with him one day, and he's like, hey, I want to continue to see you, but there's this psychiatrist that I think that you should go see, and it would be good for you to go see her. I was like,
that's always a great day.
How much farther down the rabbit hole am I going to go?
Well, it's like all these like guilt and shame of like, hey, you're saying depressed because, you know, to the outside in, your life looks very beautiful, and,
right.
and it is, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, well, then you just need to go get saved by the Lord and see the preacher, check, right?
Yeah.
And then, oh, no, you're too sick for me. You need to go see the therapist, you know? And then the therapist tells me the same story and sends me to the shrink, you know? I was sitting there, and it's like, man, I must. But what it was, yeah, it was, I was about to embark on the process of selling this business.
Okay.
And I don't know how to explain what selling a business that you founded and grew as an 18-year-old with all the, I mean, it's like
it's a piece,
I guess,
of you.
Composing, I mean, to me it's an equivalent of like spending 16 years on a piece of art and you're about to go take it to auction and sell it,
right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
and so this was a really emotional, and every day you're unsure of whether you want to sell it or not, right?
And
part of you is holding on to it, and part of us is pushing it out the door, you
right.
know. And God knew that, like, in this season of my life, He didn't send me back to treatment, but
mm-hmm.
He put a treatment team around me,
right?
You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
this minister and this therapist and this psychiatrist, and plus my wife, plus my friends, plus, I mean, this was
yeah.
He was putting a group around me
mm-hmm.
when I was going to go through the biggest kind of life change that I went through in my entire adult
major
life.
Shift.
And so I decided to sell the business, sold most of the business to a private equity group in summer of 2017. There kept all of the management team that I
mm-hmm.
had built in place.
Mm-hmm.
And so my team is now, it's a new era, you know. I mean, it's
right.
like my team is now, you know, my number two is now leading the organization and is doing
wow.
a beautiful job. And
mm-hmm.
it's neat for me to get to watch that and see
mm-hmm.
that. And so I stuck around in the CEO role and for enough time to transition that to him and really put the plans in the place for the next evolution of the company. And in that process, I transitioned to executive chairman, which is really just a board and advisory
yeah.
role to Premier.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I'm thinking about, like, well, what do I want to do next? You
yeah.
know? And it's like, so I'd like tripped and fell into parking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I
yeah.
didn't wake up
yeah.
and be like, I'm going to
ban yeah.
the parking business,
yeah.
you know? And so now it's like, well, what the hell do I want to do, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, and I just have all, and I'm kind of, I have a little bit of a shiny ball to where, you know, I mean,
yeah,
I can get excited about a lot of different things, right? And
yeah,
so it's
yeah.
like, okay, so I can get excited about 10 million things. Which do I pick,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
so I just thought that it was only going to come through prayer. And so, you know, on a lot of days, my prayer was like, hey, God, I don't want to move Betsy and the kids to a third world country. If, you know, please just
if you can keep
give
that
me
off
any
of that.
Other options other than that. But, and so I didn't know if I wanted to run anything again. You
mm-hmm.
know, I didn't know. I didn't know what I wanted to do. But the worst thing for me was to watch a good documentary or a good, you know, about
mm-hmm.
a missional, like, because I'd be like ready to go to the front lines.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like
let's
whatever
go dig
this
wells.
Is. Like,
yeah.
yeah, yeah, I'm there. And so what I just kept thinking about every day was that God gave me skills in terms of leading people, inspiring people, creating a culture and an energy in an
yeah.
organization, really building a family of people that work together,
yeah.
Creating a lofty vision, dream, goal that people think is crazy, but then assembling a team of people that think that it's possible
yeah.
and want to put together a plan to make it happen. Like, all of those are gifts that I was given,
mm-hmm.
and that was a saw that I've been sharpening and
mm-hmm.
practicing with for
mm-hmm.
a long time, and
yeah.
I don't think I'm supposed to put that on a shelf.
Yeah.
Like, I think I'm good at what I do,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
I think I should use that.
Yeah.
And then I just kept thinking about how the going to a addiction treatment center at 18 years old changed the entire, like, life was going the wrong direction at a pedal to the metal pace, right?
Yeah.
And the entire script got flipped because of a treatment center that set the course for all of these things, amazing things to happen. You know, the birth of a daughter, the birth of a son, the marrying my soulmate. I mean, all these things wouldn't have happened had it not been for that traumatic car accident and then waking up in treatment the next day, going to treatment the next day. And so that's when I said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be in the treatment business.
Wow.
I'm going to put my talents to the treatment business. And so I went out and I just started looking at a bunch of, I started telling people, right? And so when you tell people that you want to do something and they know that you've been financially successful, then opportunities just start showing up, whether they're good ones or bad ones.
I'm sure everybody and their brother had an opportunity that you could have taken
and an idea or, you know, and I mean, there's no way to shortcut the process.
Right.
Like, you just got to go through it. And like, and I don't know anything about the business. So it's like, I don't, you bring me a parking deal, I can tell you, you know, and 2 minutes whether we should do that parking deal or not.
Yeah,
I mean, you give me an addiction. I don't know what's good, what's bad, what's real, what's not. I don't know any of this, right? So I just start studying, start talking to people, and started looking at a bunch of stuff. And I just looked at several opportunities, many opportunities, and none of them were clicking, you know? And I'd get excited about some of them and work on them for some period of time. And then I'd hit a roadblock or I'd just wake up one day. I love just, I have to, I love data and I love reasoning, but my gut trumps that. You know, I enjoy them both.
Yeah.
And some days I'd just be like, I'm just out of that deal. Like, I can't pinpoint exactly why, but I just feel like it's not the one that I'm supposed to do, you know? And then I met Holly and Lee, and it was just, their approach to treatment is different. Their approach to, how we meet the individual where they're at is different. That resonated with me, because of my kind of two very different treatment experiences. You know, one wasn't one when I was 18 years old and addicted to opiates, and one when I was, you know, 31 years old and really depressed, and how those treatment experiences needed to look completely different, and how there's not a lot of that done.
Did you feel like, did you feel like there was a place maybe where those two kinds of experiences could be integrated and coexist, even if someone's not coming from the same spiritual perspectives that you found? They needed to have an integrated spiritual and clinical approach. Would that be kind of, would that be fair?
It'd be fair, you know. I mean, I think that, like, it's for me, I think a big part of treatment. I mean, people are, I mean, they're so broken when they get to the treatment level,
right?
Is that we want to provide a memorable experience that will put them on a path. Like, we can't help you, we can't fix you, right? I mean, the time allotted, and plus we're not God. Like, we gotta help you get on the right path, right? And so. What I saw was like, hey, that first time that I went to treatment, and I don't know why God wanted it to, you know, wait how, you know, more than a decade for the two, but that first time that I went to treatment, that's when I realized that it was more than me and that something was watching me, you know, and maybe that was all I was palatable for at the time, right? Maybe I would have bolted if someone started talking about Jesus at that point, right? But it's like, I got that, and that changed the path, right? And so the next time that I took that and took it up a notch and really put meat on the bone of my faith and what I believed in, right? And so realize, I think it's possible to have a place to where you are that 18-year-old, and I'm that 31-year-old, but our clinicians are so good that we can identify where that 18-year-old is, where that 31-year-old is, and we have this big tool shed, okay? And so we're going to go and we're going to say, I know where you are. I'm going to go into this tool shed. I'm going to grab. I'm going to grab tools, and I may call in some laborers that are really experts in this area, and I got a plan that came from my tool shed for you.
Right.
And you're a 31, you're that 31-year-old. I'm going to the same tool shed. I'm probably calling the same people.
Yeah.
I'm going to grab some of the same tools that I grabbed for the 18-year-old. I'm going to grab for the 31-year-old. And but I'm going to grab some different stuff, too. I think that that's the possibility. That's what we strive to do, is to is to take a vast array of tools, which are really therapeutic modalities, you know, and and experts and subject matter or modality experts, right? And put together that plan for you, whether it looks like, you know, an 18-year-old kid or a successful executive or a crack addict or a sex addict, or a, you know, to really figure out the person.
Yeah, because Ryan, you let me ask you a twofold question, kind of to move the story even further into integrative life. Where since you've acquired the treatment center and the plan, and you've got all these expert people and great, great staff and all of that. What is different about the way you all approach treatment now? What is different what makes integrative life a different experience than I might have somewhere else in the area?
And so, I mean, I think what the changes since my purchase of the business have really been about trying to create more of the beauty that was already there and then marketing the program to the masses. You know, I mean, I think that there was a people didn't so a couple things. I think people didn't either didn't know that Integrative Life Center existed. I got that a lot. You know, like KK, a therapist that I know, or Andy, another therapist that I know, like I go to them and tell them, like, hey, I got it. I found the center that I'm supposed to buy. And they're like, it's in Nashville? I've never heard of it. You know, like there's no reason if you have a treatment center that every single therapist in the city shouldn't know who you are, what you do, and some of your people.
In
right?
a recovery and, town like Nashville, too,
by the way. And so we're doing a much better job of that, or trying to do a much better job with that through marketing and with PR and processes. And then there was just a lot of back of the house functions that, you know, in terms of accounting and operations and logistics that, you know, aren't really part of
the day-to-day experience.
The client experience. But if the client doesn't know what to group room to show up to on Tuesday, that can be part of the client experience, right? Because we wanted to make it as easy as possible. And so there's just kind of cleaning up of the business, you know? And then it's really just been about, you know, hey, like, what experts can we add to the mix? Like, and doing that. And so, like, one example is we just brought on Dr. Anita Johnston to be our executive director of our eating disorder programming.
Okay.
And so Anita has written many books in the on eating disorders, incredibly recognized and respected PhD subject matter on eating disorder treatment. And so it's really just taking what we have and being like, where can we take it up a notch in terms of, you know, because that's our goal. I think that's why we're different than, so few reasons I think why we're different than others. And, you know, we're different. We're not better or worse. You know, I mean, in terms of treatment, I mean, I think that a lot of people offer amazing treatment. We just put it in different packages, and it's just whichever one you might need, you know, or, or think that you need.
Yeah.
Or
but you all, yeah, but you all do deal with process addictions there, as a, and not just substance use disorders and things like that.
So. Yeah, no, and that's a big part of, you know, so yeah, several of our clinical directors are CSAT, several of our therapists are CSATs. We have...
Now tell our listeners what
that's
a CSAT
a certified
is.
Sex addiction therapist.
Well, thank you, because we need... to make sure everybody understands.
They are near and dear to my heart.
No, it's been a learning acronyms.
I know.
Me.
It's a business of acronyms.
Getting
isn't
into
it?
A yeah. new industry. Yeah. So yeah, we have and again, that's part of having all those resources is that we want to view you as an individual, you know, our client as an individual that has lost their connection with themselves and with the greater power. And we're going to get to the symptoms and the diagnosis, how we need to get to those symptoms. We're going to start with you're a lost, searching human being. And you really have to, but in order to do that right, like, and that's part of like where I came in. It's like, in order to do that right, we got to have a team of experts to really be able to hit the uniqueness of a diagnosis or a pattern of behavior, you know? And so, but I mean, I think that that's where we try and make our magic happen.
Yeah.
Is we're going to know your name, we're going to know your story, and then we're going to really try and put a team of experts and a plan around you. As opposed to the program that I went through, which again, I credit my entire life with it, right? and I'll 100% support someone. I'm a believer of it,
absolutely.
Right? But it's just a different program. It's more of, you know, we as a center have a program that works, right? And you're going to come in, you're going to participate in our program,
right?
Where it's like we have tools that work, and we're going to put together a program for you.
Right.
We're going to put together your program.
Right.
It's
right,
just
right.
a different mentality.
Yeah. Would a fair not? And I don't mean this in a trite or a cliche way, but would you guys kind of consider yourself a boutique version of treatment? If that's not too
100%. I mean, I think that it's, we have 5 to 7 people in every one of our group therapy sessions. I mean, you'll go into other treatment providers and have, you know, a classroom size of people.
Right, sure.
And we believe in like, no one can hide in our program.
Exactly.
You know, you can't, like, you got to engage, you got to interact. You know, our average therapist caseload is 6 people.
Okay.
So, I mean, you think about a treatment center and a primary therapist having 6 clients that they're working with. You know, I mean, that is high touch, hands-on.
And those are things that make you guys a little bit different in
correct.
This area.
Yes,
so.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ryan, I could carry on this conversation for another couple of hours.
Well, thank you. This has been fun, guys. Yeah.
Well, can we ask one more question?
Sure.
Since I've dominated a bunch of questions today.
Yeah.
But let me ask one more question, Ryan.
Yeah.
Do you have a vision for other ILC places popping up? I know you're gonna not probably turn them into the premier parking of treatment.
Yeah.
But do you have visions for these places?
The one good
up?
Thing about I'm gonna predict any other ILC will have good parking.
And they will figure out the snow thing.
That's right. Exactly.
Actually, you know, one of ILC's campuses is in Music Row,
and there's a parking problem.
We don't have great parking. You know?
No.
So someone needs to come figure that out.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that I don't envision ILC getting any bigger or growing from what it is today.
Okay.
What my dream would be for the space is to, I feel that oftentimes in the space, and you know, there's tons of exceptions to the rule. This isn't a blanket statement, but in the industry of treatment, there's a lot of corporately owned treatment programs that just due to their ownership structure or the way that they're set up, that the the main goal is to create profit.
Right.
You know, they just happen to create profit through
right.
treating addiction or eating disorders or so on, right? It's not good. It's just the mm-hmm. nature. It's just the reality, right?
Right.
And then there's a lot of mom and pops, independents in the space that mm-hmm. like, a lot of them were former therapists. A lot mm-hmm. of them were former psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. They wanted to get in the business, mm-hmm. and they're not entrepreneurs,
right?
But they
right.
have a heart and soul for the business. They
right.
create a culture around their program,
right.
right? And so what my goal is to, I believe in these boutique intimate centers mm-hmm. with kind of a its own culture and identity and mm-hmm. the way that it operates. What I envision is kind of bringing it, building an umbrella
mm-hmm.
of those,
yeah.
you know, to where they're professionally managed. You know, we have good systems, we have good marketing departments, but at the heart of the center, it feels like that mom and pop, all about you, all about the client, you
right.
know, that what we've been able to achieve in ILC, that same thread is
right.
everywhere.
Runs through it all.
And I love that.
Yeah.
That you can bring more rational management and promotion to those, we'll call them ministry centers as well.
100%.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That just with a little bit of support could be doing so much more.
Yeah. yeah.
Oh, that's a great thing.
Yeah, it may be a good place to press pause here.
Yeah. Well, I hate to press pause, but I'm afraid we have to. Our time has flown. But, Ryan, I can't thank you enough for joining us here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, thank you all for having me.
Absolutely. Well,
yeah. All right, listeners, stay with us. We'll be right back in just a moment on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and Nate, this has been a really fun episode for me because, first of all, I love that Ryan has taken a tough story and really done something that's going to benefit a lot of people in a unique way.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes treatment can be a little bit one size fits all.
Yeah,
and I like the way they do things at Integrative Life Center, but I love his story and his passion for it. The fact mm-hmm. that he came into this thing, you know, the kid in a 18-year-old in a suit showing up and thinking, you know, maybe I'm going to apprentice the developer, and
yeah.
here's your stack of tickets. And
what a wonderful story!
Yeah,
and
it's incredible.
It's a great illustration of what. The change that recovery can make, and the importance of getting into treatment as early as possible.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then the fact that our need for ongoing help doesn't end.
Right.
So
right.
16 years later, 15, 14 years later, he's ready to get some more help.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself have made 2 therapy appointments in the last week.
Mm.
And I've been in recovery for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. I still see a counselor.
Sure.
And I've been sober by God's goodness since 2005. And,
yeah.
You know, it is because life changes.
Right.
You know, not just this isn't just a one-stop shop.
And I'm finally humble enough and wise enough to know that I can either spend the next few years trying to figure this my way through this on my own, using my own resources, or I can actually ask for help from outside people.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're fortunate to live in a community here in Middle Tennessee that has a lot of, I mean, we talk about it a lot, but we have a lot of resources at our disposal mm-hmm. here for recovery and help and just asking.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, once again, this has just been great. This is my favorite part of the week, I think.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
And I look forward to what we're going to do next week. We've got another guest coming up.
Another guest.
So until next week, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We are your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.